Long names of houses. Often the houses of the nine towns of the valley had quite long names, which I have sometimes shortened in translation through cowardice. I was afraid that these long names, Rain Falling Straight Down House, Here With Its Back to the Vineyards House, Dance the Sun 100 Times House, might sound quaint, that they might sound primitive. I was afraid that people who lived in houses with names like that could not be taken seriously by people who live in places with names like Chelsea Manor's Estate, An Adult Community, or Loma Lake Acres East, a planned recreation development. Though the adage runs the other way, the unfamiliar also risks contempt. The length of some of these names might also make them seem improbable. Would anybody actually say, "Do come see us, we live in Nine Buzzards Over the Mountain House in Kastohana"? In fact, they probably wouldn't, since anyone they talked to would very likely know where they lived. In the uncommon event of inviting strangers, they would mention the house's location or looks in the southeast arm with red doors on the porches by way of address, as we might say, 2116½ Garden Court Drive. You take the second San Mateo exit going north and turn right at the third stoplight and go 2 blocks. Anyhow, the people of the valley had no objection to long names. They liked them. Perhaps they enjoyed the fact that they had plenty of time to say them. They were not ashamed of having time. They lacked drive, that great urge to get done which powers us, sending us forward, ever faster, reducing San Francisco of the slow settlers to Frisco, and Chicago of the even slower natives to Shy, and the town of the Mission of Our Lady of the Angels becomes Los Angeles, but that takes too long, so it becomes L.A. But jets go faster than we do, so we use their language and call it lax, because what we want is to move on quick, to go fast, get through, be done, done with everything. To get it over with, that's what we want. But the people who lived in the valley and gave interminable names to their houses were in no hurry. It is hard for us to conceive, harder to approve, of a serious adult person not in a hurry. Not being in a hurry is for infants, people over 80, bums, and the third world. Hurry is the essence of city, the very soul. There is no civilization without hurry, without keeping ahead. The hurry may lurk invisible, contradicted by the indolent pose of the lounger at the bar or the lazy gait of the stroller along the hotel walkway, but it is there, in the terrific engines of the TWA or BSA supersonic planes that brought her from Rio, him from Rome, here to New York, New York for the IGPSA conference on implementation of GEPS, and will rush them back tomorrow, hurrying across the world of cities where there is no tense left but the present tense, every second and tenth of a second and millisecond and nanosecond clocked, the readout moving always a little faster and the A rising. Mozart's A was 140 cycles a second, so Mozart's piano was out of tune with all our orchestras and singers. Our A is 160, because the instruments sound more brilliant tuned up higher, as they all rise like sirens towards the final scream. There is nothing to be done. There is no way to heighten the pitch of the instruments of the valley, no way to abbreviate their institutions and addresses and names to capital letters, no way to get them to move ahead. As their names tended to spread out and take time to say or write, so the houses themselves tended to take up room and elaborate themselves, a porch added on here, a wing there, so that the essentially simple plan might, over the slow lapse of years, burgeon and bulge and exfoliate like an old oak tree vastly gnarled and spacious. The basic plan was usually an oblong or a shallow V-shape, the foundation being of half-sunk fieldstone, on which 2 stories, in stone, adobe brick, or wood, were built. Washrooms, workrooms, storage rooms, and such were in the basement. The first and second floors, they counted down from the roof, were divided into hearth rooms, kitchens, and sleeping rooms and porches, 4 or 5 rooms to a floor in the small houses, 12 or 15 in the big ones. Such a house might contain 1 numerous household, or as many as 5 different households. Generally, 2 or 3 households shared a house, often for generations. Each family had at least 1 private entrance, so there might be several outside staircases to the upper and lower porches and balconies. It was on these porches that most of the life of the house went on, except in cold weather. Many houses had no front and back. The front of the top floor might be the back of one ground floor household and the side of the other. It depended on where your front door was. The foundation story was often set out to get the light on the northwest side and retired under the upper floor and balconies for summer shade on the southeast side, which gave such houses a lurching look. But they were soundly planned and built and often stood for centuries. A house was oriented to the local terrain and lightfall, hill slopes, other houses, trees, creeks, shade, and sun patterns, and secondarily to the compass, the corners pointing north, east, south, west, which meant that the walls faced the preferred half directions. The siting of the house was determined by the ideal plan of the town, the Heia'if figure. Each house made part of that pattern, an element of the left arm curving to meet the right arm of the five Heimas buildings at the hinge of the town, which was always running water or a well. The pattern was not neat or orderly, neither was the town, and nothing was in rows, yet the shape was there and was felt, the interlocked curves springing from, returning to, the center. In Kastohana and Telinana, there were several left arms, for to build so many houses in a single curve would either have crammed them together or strung them out inconveniently. The area within the loose curve of the houses, planted with some trees and perhaps containing a few sheds or booths, but mostly left open and mostly either muddy or dusty, was the common place of the town. The corresponding empty area within the curve of the five Heimas on the right arm of town was called the dancing place, but both places were common, and they danced in both. One town of the nine did not quite fit this description. Tachas Tochas was, notoriously, settled by people from outside, from the northwest, traditionally. Certainly the village architecture showed a likeness to the styles of towns far north of the valley, on the west-running rivers of the redwood lands. The houses of Tachas Tochas were all wood, redwood or cedar, with shallow cellars and no use of adobe. They stood so close that they shared rain gutters, in a tight curve, all facing inward. The hinge of the town was a lively falls in Shasash Creek, and the right arm was laid out and built conventionally. But the circle of dark, tall, steep-roofed houses under the sheer rise of Bone Mountain, black-green with fir, was somberly impressive and quite different from any other valley town. Disapproval of the tightness of the town plan was frequently expressed outside it. Inside it, the people of Tachas Tochas rebuilt, when, from century to century, a house must be taken down and replaced, in their immemorial and peculiar fashion, which perhaps did express or encourage a tight, aloof, interned quality in the character and manners of the townsfolk. Wakwaha, at the other end of the valley world, was also exceptional, being the Benares, Rome, or Mecca of the valley, much visited by people from the other towns, its left arm included five long, single-story hostels maintained by the five houses, where visitors could housekeep for a few days or for months. And the right arm took in more area than the left, containing not only the five great Heimas, but a dozen or more buildings of public and sacred use and significance, such as the archives, the conservatory, and the theater. The hinge of Wakwaha was one of the high sources of the Na, a beautiful, steady spring rising from the volcanic rocks of a deep canyon head of the mountain. The site was a difficult one to put a fair-sized town on, but the steep, uneven ground and the sweep of the mountain slopes and canyon walls above and below the town gave it both grandeur and charm. Some of the houses of Wakwaha were very old, built of the stone they stood on and seeming to have grown from it. The madrones that shaded their roofs and walled courts were immense, but the walls had been there long before the trees. They had old, long names, these houses. Rising up from where the quarrel ended was one of them. Another was called Jackrabbit's Grandmother's Hole House. But then some equally old had very short names. There was a house called Wind, a house called High, and others had names that had lost their meaning over the years, worn away by the changing of the language. Angrawad House, Ofechohe House. Though people in a small society may talk slowly, their language is likely to change quickly. Even written, it keeps flowing, leaving the old spellings and usages high and dry. So the names of the nine towns, being old, had no translatable meaning, except for Wakwahana, the town at the holy spring of the Na, but it could also mean the dancing way of the Na. Chukulmas probably meant live oak house originally, and the Mal in Onmalin is hill or hillock. The people of Tachas Tochas insisted, without offering evidence, that the name of their town in their forgotten northern tongue meant where the bear sat down. But why Sinshan and its mountain were Sinshan, or what Kastoha meant and why it changed, as it apparently had done, from Hastoha, and why the oldest house in Madidino was called Madidino Animon, nobody knew. No doubt the etymologies could have been traced from data in the memory banks of the City of Mind, with a few weeks or months of work at the exchange. But what for? Need every word be translated? Sometimes the untranslated word might serve to remind us that language is not meaning, that intelligibility is an element of it only, a function. The untranslated word or name is not functional. It sits there. Written, it is a row of letters, which, spoken with a more or less wild guess at the pronunciation, produces a complex of phonemes, a more or less musical and interesting sound, a noise, a thing. The untranslated word is like a rock, a piece of wood. Its use, its meaning, is not rational, definite, and limited, but concrete, potential, and infinite. To start with, all the words we say are untranslated words.